in, back in, back in, back in. Shut it.
It was still 43 degrees out the west end of the island, with winds that were very strong, lots of fuel, and we had massive firestorms. The world just changed for Kangaroo Island.
I didn't go to the farm for the first few days because my husband asked me not to. He didn't think I would be mentally strong enough at that stage to see the devastation, and I'm glad I didn't.
I don't think anyone was prepared for how horrific it was going to be. Definitely is not anything that's going to leave anyone's minds anytime soon. It was, yeah, really, really heartbreaking to see.
This episode contains stories of animals in distress. This is From the Embers, sharing the voices of people and communities impacted by Australia's devastating summer of 2019. I'm Sarah Mashman. Kangaroo Island is a wild and windswept landscape, and there are two ways to get there from the mainland: catching the ferry from Cape Jervis, a 1.5 hour drive south of Adelaide, or by plane.
We're surrounded by big, beautiful she oaks and lovely corias and acacias, and we have lots of resident wallabies and kangaroos and goannas and echidnas around that come and visit us daily. And we're just about a 5 minute walk to the beach, so on certain evenings when it's really still, we can hear the waves crashing. I'm Kate Wells, and I live in Sapphire Town, which is sort of the end of Island Beach on Kangaroo Island. So I moved here when I was a very young backpacker from America, and I've been here about 26 years.
I love the beautiful beaches and the space, all the animals. It's just really pretty, and it's untouched.
Sabrina Davis is from Germany. More than a decade ago, she decided to backpack around the world and
see this faraway country that I never really heard much about, and ended up here as a woofer. And it's a willing worker on organic farms, and ended up falling in love with the Kangaroo Island man, and yeah, I'm still here.
They can sense whether you're loving them or whether you're just being rough and... So if you're gentle, bees just carry on doing what they are.
Peter Davis has lived on Kangaroo Island all his life.
My parents had bees as long ago as I can remember. When I left school, I took over the 12 hives that we had on the farm.
Peter looks after what are called Ligurian bees that were brought to Kangaroo Island from northern Italy.
The government of South Australia passed legislation to make Kangaroo Island a sanctuary for them in 1885. So we are now the oldest bee sanctuary in the world, the place where you'll find the purest Ligurian bees in the world.
Peter had over 1,000 hives spread across the island, from which 100 tonnes of honey were extracted each year. His business is based in Kingscote, on the island's east side.
Bees are a very special industrious insect that is very organised, and once you get hooked on bees, you become very hooked and passionate.
They just produce from what is growing at the moment. You can taste how wonderful, beautiful Kangaroo Island is. You can taste it in the honey.
The Kangaroo Island man that Sabrina fell in love with is Peter's youngest son, Ben.
I thought it was fate that I met him because my German childhood nickname literally translates to bee in English, and so I thought I was meant to meet a beekeeper one day. When I came here, I worked for my now brother-in-law and learned a lot in the time and realised how clever these little creatures are and how much they are like me as well, because they like a good solid 25 degrees. They don't like rain. They don't like wind.
January is the windiest time on Kangaroo Island.
The island is not only known for the wildness of its creatures, but for the unpredictability of its elements.
We understand the power of nature. We understand the importance of nature.
That's Jane Bates. She was the island's mayor for 8 years. She and her family are all members of the Country Fire Service, the CFS.
We're a native vegetation landscape. We have lots of fires. 56% of our fires start with lightning.
The fires actually started here on about the 20th of December, and we had a couple of lightning strikes out on the north coast.
When lightning hit the Duncan area on the north coast, Kate was working at the nearby wildlife park.
It was about 44 degrees. A big storm cloud came over. It rained torrentially for about 10 minutes, so much so that the park actually flooded because it had been quite dry before that. And then as soon as it stopped, we could all smell smoke. And so in that moment, not that far from the wildlife park, a lightning strike had lit up the scrub. All of us were thinking, what's going to happen next? We had to actually be inside, not just because of the rain, but because the lightning was so close.
The area around Duncan burned for 2 weeks. The wildlife park was spared, but the fire consumed homes, farmland, and livestock. Peter and his two sons were at the fire grounds.
We spent days fighting those fires and we had them pretty much under control. And then on the 29th of December, there were two more lightning strikes out in Flinders Chase.
When it broke from Flinders Chase, that movement, we've never seen it before. It's something we have never experienced ever as a community. Normally about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you get the temperature dropping, the dew coming in, and our fires will calm down. And also if there's a southwesterly change coming, we go ripper.
The southwesterly is usually what brings a cool change. But this time was different.
Both those runs, both those big, devastating, uncontrollable firestorms happened on southwesterlies.
Which meant when the wind changed southwest, it was still incredibly hot.
It was still 43 degrees out the west end of the island, with winds that were very strong, lots of fuel, and we had massive firestorms. The world just changed for Kangaroo Island.
For a while there, I did the radio, so one radio to the whole fire ground.
Jane was working around the clock in Incident Management Team Operations, or IMT.
The operations is a lockdown room where all the radio communications come in, everything goes out to the fire ground, so it's privileged but demanding. The IMT was in Kingscote. I took toothbrush and a change of undies because I thought I'm probably not going to get home tonight. We had all the 000 calls coming to one pager in the room, so those had to be listened to, logged. We had to grid them, find out where they were, pass it onto the fire ground with accuracy. You know, apart from the messages they're coming back in, they might need extra resources, they might need planes, they might need helicopters, they might need extra people. But there was people that were doing that day in and night, of course, for the whole period.
And living in a small community, there's always a chance there'll be someone you know on the other end of that 000 call or in one of the fire trucks.
And there was one night where, after the fire ran the second time, operation spent till very late in the evening trying to get every fire truck a safe route home. And we had an emergency call come in of someone who was in a very difficult predicament, a local whose car had broken down. So we decided the only thing we could do was turn one truck back to go. And I knew my son was on that truck. I knew he was sensible. I knew his crew was good. But, yeah, I'm a mum. Mum's worry.
I fully trusted my husband. He's been a firefighter for most of his life and his father has been very involved in the CFS in the last 50 or so years.
On the 3rd of January, Sabrina and her family were preparing to evacuate from their sheep farm.
So this time I waited and waited until the boys looked really worried and then I said, shall I go? And they said, I think you should. From our house, there were two roads to get to safety. South Coast Road was already on fire, so we couldn't go that way. So we had to go the other way. So they escorted us out to the West End Highway, which was about 1:30 on the 3rd. And we just made that our own decision. And the boys stayed behind to defend the house.
Her husband, father and brother-in-law stayed behind. The sky at this point was split almost down the middle, with sun on one side and fire and smoke on the other.
My daughter said it perfectly. She said, "I don't like looking out of my window because my window looks scary." Everything on her side was black and smoky, and you could see flames in the distance, probably about 10 kilometres away. And my son just answered, "Just look out of my window. It's beautiful on my side." And so when we drove out, the fire was behind us, so all we could see was blue sky.
At the wildlife park, animals were being brought in by fire crews and locals.
The koalas on Kangaroo Island are really special. They are one of the last disease-free populations around Australia. So, yeah, their genetics are very, very important to pretty much saving their species.
That's Dana Mitchell. She and her husband Sam own the park. They have an 18-month-old son, Connor.
The 1st of January was when we first started getting koalas coming in from the fire grounds. So, yeah, I think we had the first kind of 7 to 14 on the 1st of January, and then they just started coming in every day after that. There was a lot of crews coming from all around Australia just to go out rescuing. There's been locals out on grounds every day that have brought us over 100 koalas. And then, yeah, just groups from around Australia that have come over and rescue what they can. Back in the beginning when they were coming in, they were in pretty horrific condition. The burns were really bad. There was some coming in with bones exposed and no skin or muscle or anything left. I don't think anyone was prepared for how horrific it was going to be. Definitely is not anything that's going to leave anyone's minds anytime soon. It was, yeah, really, really heartbreaking to see.
So many injured koalas were arriving that they ran out of enclosures. In one day, 68 koalas were admitted. So Sam and Dana made space in their own home to look after them.
We had all the little ones, all the joeys. Most we had in there at one time was about 35 of them. We started off just cable tying together whatever we had here. They were in the middle of fires, so there was nothing open to be able to get supplies and all that kind of thing. So we just worked with what we had and went from there to just keep building until we had enough room for everyone. When you get them from the wild, obviously it's a wild animal. They're also injured, so they're in a lot of pain and they're just trying to fight. Once they start getting their pain relief and their treatment, and they kind of, I think they just kind of understand that we're here trying to help them, we're trying to make them feel better, and pain relief goes a long way to doing that.
Joeys were also brought in for recovery. Some were so young, they were still in the phase of holding on to mum.
So they're used to cuddling something. So all being in the enclosure, they actually gave them each other a lot of comfort as well. So they just saw each other as mum, and, yeah, we just had big balls of little joeys cuddling each other.
Oh, look out, here goes a... Oh! Hold that door. Hold the door open.
Come in.
Yeah.
Back on the home front, Peter and his boys were defending the family farm.
Yeah, you down front. Keep going. Can you squirt it? Squirt the pump. Back in. Shut it.
It was the worst day of my life.
Yeah, well, we tried. We saved two utes. Unfortunately, the house is alight. Gotta go.
We lost our farm on the 3rd of January. That was the day the children and the dogs and me evacuated.
New Davis is still coming behind us.
Still coming, just crossed the bridge.
Yes, right behind me. Can't see your lights now. Yep.
And up until that night, about 10 p.m. when my husband returned and told us that he couldn't protect the house and they lost it, and the farm and the stock. Yeah, I never imagined that. I thought the boys had a good chance from the fires that they had been fighting the 2 weeks prior because, you know, they have been able to protect all other houses. So many got hit at the same time that unfortunately no one came. It was just them.
While Peter was out fighting the fires, he'd had something else on his mind. His bees.
They use water that they carry into the hives and they fan it. So it's an evaporative air conditioning system that keeps their hive regulated.
And his heart was breaking because he knew bees followed their instincts in the heat.
They always go back to their hive. They stay in their hive. They stay in their hive to keep it cool. So when the fire comes along, the whole hive just burnt. And all the bees. It was very traumatic to see the devastation. A couple of our blokes went out after 2 days. We couldn't go out before that because we were still fighting fires. And it was a horrible job going around taking photos. I didn't go out. I actually went out afterwards.
The same morning that fire had tore through their property, Sabrina's husband had picked up 40 hives, ready for honey extraction. They were packed and waiting outside their house.
He had them on the back of the truck and the fire went over and burnt the truck completely, and there was this big river of honey running from the truck all the way from the house down to the shed, and then that got burnt as well. And then it was still obviously smelling good because all the birds that had tried to get away from the fire returned and found the honey on the track. They tried to get in it to find some sort of food, but unfortunately they all got stuck in the honey in the end. I didn't go to the farm for the first few days because my husband asked me not to. He didn't think I would be mentally strong enough at that stage to see the devastation, and I'm glad I didn't. He had a lot of nightmares after, and what he had seen and what they had to do, you know, bury the stock and remove a lot of the stock as well. That was tough, even for the boys that have seen a lot. We originally thought it was just, you know, one big fire that was just moving along slowly. And then when we were talking to all our friends and family and neighbours, we found out that it was sort of spreading a lot faster than expected, and that it was spreading like little fingers along the map, reaching up, you know, first southeasterly, and then it was spreading up north. And so it took half of the island in about 6 hours, and it travelled distances of about 70 kilometres. So friends of ours that lived 60 kilometres away from us lost their house only 2 hours after us.
So there is nothing normal about that fire, and I think we realise our world's changed. And as a community, we desperately need to talk about that going forward. Otherwise, we go forward without building an extra level of resilience.
The fires moved across the island to the east, painting the bushland red, then black, and stopping just 4 kilometres from the airport.
The end date was pretty good when they finally called it contained. It was a good day.
They weren't really under control until we had a rain about the 16th of January.
On the 31st of January, the heavens opened.
Our whole community was grey. Our trees were grey, our cars were grey, our shops were, even the oval was grey. And that 50 mil around, was all of a sudden there was this brightness. It was like the colour returned to our life. It was a great way to lift your spirits, you know, was the clincher, absolute clincher. Knowing that it would start the germination again, it would start the recovery in our native edge, it would clean off the air hole remnants of the fire from your houses, your cars, your community, everything you were looking at.
You can now drive across entire sections of Kangaroo Island without seeing burnt land. But the scars are still there.
It's brought our community closer together, especially the people that have been most affected, directly infected. But it's not just the people who had their places burnt that are affected. It's every business on Kangaroo Island. It's every person on Kangaroo Island. Even the elderly people in the hospital feel the pain that we're going through. when they see the news, when they see, talk to their friends or family. So the whole community is affected.
As you can probably tell when I'm talking about it, it's still really raw, even it's been 2.5 months and I still sort of get really teary when we talk about it. And I try to talk about it regularly with family to let it all out. It does build up still. I wish it wouldn't have happened to all of my friends, but in saying that, I'm also very glad we're all in it together because it has made it easy for all of us. I think if we were the only house that would have burnt down, I think it would have been harder for us to mentally cope with it. My husband still receives phone calls regularly, so he has someone to talk to at least once a fortnight. And I go and see someone in town. I always just see the same lady and you just, it's good. It's sort of a mixture of talking to friends and talking to family, talking to other affected, which is mostly friends anyway, and then talking to a professional just to see if you're really down, if that's, you know, normal.
And you can see the trauma that's still there. Some of them handle it a bit better than others. Some of them, I think the long-term effects will be extraordinary and mightn't have even hit them just yet. But I think we're all aware as a community the health and well-being of each other. So while I think people in the burnt-out ground have reached a point where they want to stop being treated like a victim, they want to just have a normal conversation, you know, how's the weather, rather than that victim conversation. I think there's still a great need to watch and assist for a long, long while.
I mean, farmers are incredibly resilient because not only do they deal with things like this, but they also deal with droughts and, you know, having to shoot their stock when there's no water or their crops fail.
And it wasn't just the humans who were emotionally and physically exhausted. The wildlife felt it too.
They're down and out, they're stressed, they're depressed, they've just kind of sit there, and as they go through treatment and get towards the end of it, you do see them, they start perking up, they start taking their bottles and all the adults start climbing perches and eating, and yeah, it's definitely very lifting when you see them getting to the other side of it and starting to be koalas again.
We probably lost 20 tonne of honey that day in the hives that were burnt.
45% of Peter's hives were gone. But others on the island had lost around 60% of their hives.
There's mixed emotions when you go to a site and you see 20 or 30 of your hives all burnt and there's one left. And you look at it and you think, how did that one survive? Some of the sites where we had hives, every hive burnt. Others, it was random, but all of them were so heat affected that often the queen becomes infertile. And we're still finding hives where the queens stop laying and the population, because the workers only live for a short time, the population's diminished to such an extent that the hive's not viable anymore. If the bees don't have a lot of food coming in, then they do lose their energy. Once they've eaten the stores out of their hive, and if we're not putting them on areas where there's more pollen and nectar coming in, then we have to feed them. And we're feeding a lot of hives at present. And we feed them sugar syrup and a pollen substitute or a protein supplement.
Peter thinks it'll take 5 to 7 years for the hives to recover from the fire's impact.
And we won't be building up our numbers of hives in that time. We'll be looking after what we've got. Already, if you go into these areas, there are lots of new plants, lots of shooting plants, new shoots on trees, because that's how they survive. There is lots of animals out there still. The animals and birds have a great ability to survive in these conditions. So we need to celebrate that. We need to celebrate the new growth. The other thing that gives me hope is my son and daughter-in-law lost their whole farm. They have moved from the western end of the island to Kingscote, and now my daughter-in-law is working in our business. And we have succession in our business now, whereas we were talking about it and it was going to be about 3 to 5 years. Now it's happened. So great things come out of bad things sometimes.
Most people that know me know that wildlife is my world. And so to hear farmer friends that have lost their homes, all of their stock, all of their fencing, tell me that they've seen 5 kangaroos in the bush and they're really healthy looking, gives me hope, because they're looking at that as a positive thing and they know that that will make me smile. And I've got a little koala that came to me from the fires and she's doing really well and all of her burns are healed and she's very spunky and bitey, and which is good because that means she'll be tough when she goes for release. And yeah, so things like that give me hope.
You've been listening to From the Embers. This series has been brought to you by the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia and is supported by the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas and the Paul Ramsey Foundation. Our guests were Kate Wells, Sabrina Davis, Peter Davis, Jane Bates and Dana Mitchell. Special thanks to Sarah Stronglaw, the Davis family, Pat Crowther, Graham Waters, Brooke and Reese, Michael Pengelly and Sean Wheatra. Also thanks to the Kangaroo Island Wildlife Park and 5 Kicks FM community radio station. The producer was Lisa Burns. Engineering by Tegan Nichols. Script consultation from Zoe Ferguson. The theme composer was Oliver Beard. The production management team was Vicky Rouse and Abe Killian.
And the executive producer was Sarah Mashman.
This podcast was made on lands of significance to the Njarrindjeri, Wurundjeri, Kaurna and Noongar peoples, and the land of the Muwinina people from country around Nipaluna. These lands were never ceded.